Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast. I'm your host, Des Latham. Episode 238, and it's going to be full of legal back and forth, all about the Langalibalele Rebellion. Another little war, as the London Times called it. All action at Bushman's River Pass, after which British engineers will be sent to blow up bits of the Drakensberg. In 1873, Benjamin Chili Campbell Pine was reappointed as Lieutenant Governor of Natal. Pine was a career officer in the British Colonial Services. This was the second time he was taking up the post of Lieutenant Governor in Natal. His first stint was logged between April 1850 and March 1855. And Pinetown, on the hills above Durban, is named after him. He spent time in the Gold Coast and Ghana, then the West Indies, as governor of the Leeward Islands and Antigua. His second stint in Natal was going to be cut short because of how he was going to deal with the Langalibalele affair. Pine's administration had to contend with the Shepston system, a policy of indirect rule developed by Theophilus. This controversially separated African and European populations as a kind of apartheid precursor and was a dominant force in Natal's governance during Pine's tenure. While Pine and Shepston collaborated, their administrations also faced criticism from white settlers who wanted more land, more labour, and the financing of native policy. Shepston would hold the post of Secretary of Native Affairs, or SNA, for decades, speaking both isiZulu and isiXhosa. He had a great deal of knowledge of African law and customs. The other main character of our tale today was Langalibalele, the hereditary chief of the Amahlubi tribe, from around 1836. After fleeing Zululand in 1849, he and his fellow refugees were granted land by the colonial authorities in the Escort district, west of the town, along the Msuluzi and Mchezi rivers. The town was laid out by Colonel Escort in 1847 and named after the British officer. The land the Amahlubi were handed was technically not for free. The obligations included protecting the colony from the San Raiders, some galloping in from as far away as the Maluti Mountains. Langalibalele and his people were part of the Shepston system, granted their own territories separated from white farms. 10 years after arriving in their fertile, rolling, hilled landscape, Langalibalele headed off to Eswatini, Swaziland, where he fetched his head wife, Mzamosi, in 1857. There was some confusion about what the Amahlubi were expected to do. Essentially, their role was to form a buffer zone in the region, and they were even presented with some guns for that purpose. And once jobs opened up on the diamond mines, hundreds of Amahlubi men headed off to labour in Griqualand West, returning with valuable goods like horses and more guns and ammunition. The people flourished through the 1860s and into the early 1870s and were at peace with the colonial farmers. The Amahlubi grew from 7,000 to 10,000 souls, with 15,000 head of cattle. Their original 364 square kilometres of land extended to more than 700 square kilometres. But the relationship with the British authorities was riven by confusion and distrust. Although blacks in the Natal colony were governed according to customary law in their own reserves, so to speak, the colonial administration frequently applied the law in ways that roused deep suspicion and fear amongst the chiefs and their followers. They interfered. Langalibalele refused to allow a count of the cattle in his district, seen as a precursor to the British taxing his cows. He became an influential chief, travelling with a large entourage of well-mounted and armed men. He was also thought to be imbued with some magic qualities and could summon rain, it was said. Mzamosi, his wife, was an astute businesswoman, and Amahlubi oral tradition speaks of how she would dispatch lower-ranking men and women off to Kimberley and, according to the stories told, would seize all of the cash they brought back. At the same time, the system of isiBalo, or forced labour, began to chafe the Amahlubi. A magistrate had the power to unilaterally order chiefs to provide men to build public projects, specifically roads. The chiefs didn't like that one little bit. Langalibalele frequently refused requests for labour, infuriating the magistrates and the settlers. When they were called upon to provide a force to join the British in their war against Basutu King Moshoeshoe in 1851, it took years to get payment for this and further soured their view of the British administration. Add into this mix, The fact that Langalibalele Belele had used his family in a traditional sense to shore up his base across southern Africa. By all accounts, he had 54 sons and 68 daughters who were influentially married into the Amatembu, the Amatxhosa, and even the Amamfengu across the Fish River in the Eastern Cape. He also had kingsmen in Basutoland. Then, of course, he was directly connected to the Swazi royal line through his wife Mzimozi, who was one of the daughters of King Mswati I. Natal was isolated from the hinterland by the formidable Drakensberg Mountains and surrounded by black nations, increasing the paranoia of the settlers. The Amamtembu, Amaxhosa to the south, were respected, not to mention the AmaZulu to the northeast. Communication with the Cape was slow along a few roads and by sea. There were also few transport corridors in Natal itself, which engendered a feeling of insecurity among the colonists. Shepston's artificially revived tribal system included grouping fragmentary clans together under unborn chiefs. Those are chiefs who he summarily declared chiefs, but were not of royal blood born. Laws were frequently ignored by these people because of the distances and a lack of police and military force. Alcohol, horses, guns, unauthorized squatting became the order of the day. Most black Natalians were fairly submissive until 1873. A muddled relationship was about to be tested when the colonial authorities asked Langalibalele to send men to join a government column tracking down Manchana Kamundisi of the Sithole people. The magistrate who ordered Manchana's arrest was John McFarlane, who owned land in the Vienan area and had often expressed frustration with the African chiefs in the district. He called out the local commando, but Manchana retreated into Basutoland. The weather was dreadful. Heavy snowfalls slowed the colonists and the Amatlubi impi down. John Shepston, the brother of Theophilus Shepston, was part of the commando and eventually lured Manchana into a trap, persuading him and the members of his tribe to leave their weapons outside for a peaceful meeting, while Shepston and his men concealed their firearms. This was like a reversal of Dingaan Piet Retief. This resulted eventually in the death of 30 of Manchana's warriors, and Langalibalele took note. Is this how the British conducted negotiations? McFarlane had also ordered some of the Amatlubi to be flogged for refusing to serve. That led to a public rebuke by the Lieutenant Governor Pine, upset that the magistrate had failed to ask permission to go after Manchana, not to mention the flogging. The Natal administration was highly sensitive to arbitrary acts by its officials because it had minimal military and police resources to back up its authority. Then Langalibalele demanded payment for the use of his warriors, but the Natal administrators dragged their bureaucratic feet in coughing up. By 1873, the Amatlubi were supplying grain to both Pietermaritzburg and to the Kimberley diamond fields. Amatlubi were using metal ploughs instead of the traditional hoe. Their production began to threaten settler farmers at the same time as a labour shortage threatened the larger plantations. As the labour drained away to either farm their own land around Vienan and Escort or to head off to earn a relatively good wage in Kimberley, the relationship between the Amatlubi and the white farming community was on a slippery slope. Then the Natal authorities introduced a marriage tax and decided to fix the price of lobola. This was known as the Imbidli Ka Somseu, or the Multitudes of Somseu, Shepston's African name. This unpopular new tax was due to come into effect, but before it did, hundreds of Amatlubi rushed to finalize their marriages, bypassing the tax. Shepston summoned Langalibalele to Escort to face questioning, and the two men had an altercation when Shepston called Langalibalele an old woman. Bad feelings grew. Rumours surged that the British were going to seize cattle belonging to the Amatlubi and their neighbours further west up against the Drakensberg, the Amangwane. Shepston then quelled the rumours. All the while, traditional power linkages were breaking amongst the Amatlubi themselves as young men returned with new clothes and money, many weakening the old chiefdoms. It's quite a fascinating saga. The Amabutu regiments were turning into labour brokers of sorts. The Intaba Yeswi, Msingapansi, the Impumbangingeni, the Isicheleha, the Imihoshi, Izinkonjani, the Nguboyinkosi, and the Amangwani, all represented amongst the diamond field labourers. This practice was also what was taking place among the Pedi of the northeastern Transvaal. A rapid transformation was sweeping across southern Africa, shaking up the old chiefdoms. Some leaders would respond quickly, as Langalibalele's wife Mzimozi did, Others would discover that their hold on power would slip away in the coming decades. The chiefs were determined to hold on to their people, and Langali Balele feared that these colonial labor and tax obligations would ultimately disperse his tribe and erode his power base. With the British tinkering with the marriage tax and the effect of the Amahlubi hastening their marriages, Macfarlane and even Shepstone believed it was tantamount to defrauding the government. So Langali Balele was fined £10. Bishop Colenso, meanwhile, was snapping at both Shepstone and Natal authorities. He said that the Natal marriage tax was far more expensive than the usual payment for Lobola among the Amahlubi. They also had a tradition well known of marrying large groups of girls of the same age set together. It was not an act of fraud, he said. So as you can sense in the sea of furrowed brows and wrinkled foreheads, it would come a final straw. 14 years earlier, Law 5 of 1859 had prevented blacks from possessing firearms without the Lieutenant Governor's permission. No one had followed the law. Here were the Amahlubi buying firearms like crazy, registering none. Because the Natal authorities had turned a blind eye for so long, the coming sudden attempt to enforce the law was going to backfire. While the colonial government saw little need for guns and African hands, except for in cases I've explained, they had used the Amahlubi as buffers against the sand raiders. Macfarlane and other magistrates wanted the chiefs to be reined in. Before 1873, a pitiful few guns were registered, but with the reappointment of Pine, the slack gun control enforcement was about to change. Rumours circulated that Langali Balele was encouraging his warriors to obtain guns and not to register them, and even persuading other black clans to do the same. Because he was so well known across southern Africa, fear grew. There was also some truth to the rumour, but he denied this. Anyway, the British had ignored the gun issue previously. What was the big problem now was his attitude. In early March 1873, John Macfarlane singled Langali Balele and the Amahlubi out and demanded the registration of their guns in terms of Law 5. Langali Balele said he was too busy and suffering from an illness and could not be expected to march off across a vast area looking for about 2,000 men and trying to count their guns. I mentioned the internal dynamics changing, and it was the younger members of the Amahlubi who objected loudest to the registration process. They prized their guns earned on the diamond mines. Furthermore, Langali Balele had miscalculated just how serious Pine and Macfarlane were, and historians say it was a serious lack of judgment on the old man's part. Shepstone and Macfarlane were angry, adding fuel to the fire of an already prickly relationship. Between April and October 1873, Langali Balele was summoned numerous times to appear personally before the Secretary of Native Affairs, Shepstone, the SNA. It was a deliberately framed instruction to demean the chief, so he refused, not wishing to appear weak. Trying to mend fences, in April, Langali Balele visited Macfarlane in Vienna to explain that he had to consult with the senior chiefs before going ahead with this gun count. Macfarlane was absent. Then a quarrel ensued between the interpreter with the name of Rudolph and Langali Balele that further strained the relationships. And in May, messengers sent to summon Langali Balele were ordered to wait for days before they were ushered into the chief's hut. One claimed later he had been stripped. The Amahlubi oral history paints a slightly different picture. Either way, Langali Balele was taking no chances, having seen what happened to Manjani, so he was checking the messengers for firearms. Then came reports of British soldiers assembling an escort. This caused panic amongst the Hlubi. The third request followed in October and included an ultimatum this time with the threat of dismemberment of his tribe. Still, Langali Balele did not obey. Instead, he sent high-ranking tribe members to Magistrate Macfarlane to pay the fine, he said, for his tardiness. But Macfarlane refused to accept the money, insisting Langali Balele appear himself. Macfarlane had made such a song and dance about this that he and the British had painted themselves into a strategic corner, as had Langali Balele. His public refusal could not go unpunished, or other chiefs may take heed of his attitude, and then the British administration would be in serious trouble. On the 27th of October 1873, on the evidence presented by Lieutenant Governor Pine of Langali Balele's rebellious conduct, the Executive Council gave him 24 hours to surrender or be punished for rebellious conduct in disobeying the order of the Supreme Chief and defying the authority of the government of Her Majesty the Queen. He was accused of treason, a crime technically punishable by death. Lang Ali Balele ignored this demand, and Pine ordered his arrest, leaving his women, children, and the elderly. The Amahlubi and an allied group, the Amaputini, began moving the warriors and cattle towards Drakensberg. The colonial forces consisted of a black militia supported by the Natal Carbineers, a volunteer force, along with units of the regular army. These were all mobilized under command of Lieutenant Governor Pine. "I consider it my bounden duty to be with the troops," he said later. That meant he was going to be able to experience the ignominious events that were to transpire firsthand. Pine sent a strong force to block the possible escape route through the Drakensberg at Giant's Castle, then through a cordon around the Amahlubi and Amaputili locations, following which the plan was he would arrest Lang Ali Balele, and if he came quietly, he would pardon all the others. Captain Hawkins galloped off towards the southern Drakensberg. A second column under Captain Lucas and Captain Allison of the native contingent headed off to the source of the Little Tugela and Bushman's rivers. Pine was to be the central pin, and he set up camp at Moshlin, from where a force under Captain Hoyes set out towards Giant's Castle. Another force of Natal Carbineers, the volunteers, and Basutu guides, led by Major Durnford, set out for the Bushman's River Pass. They were to join up with Captain Allison there, along with his hundreds of black soldiers. What happened next would be called Another Little War by the London Times newspaper. For some inexplicable reason, the colonial forces believed they would just romp up the Drakensberg and capture the Amahlubi leader. Dusting of hands, done deal. The reality was going to be very different, because the Drakensberg isn't called the Barrier of Spears in isiZulu or the Dragon's Mountain in Dutch for nothing. The Natal government had not conducted a proper survey of the colony's terrain. Their maps were sketchy, to put it mildly. Just to add to Pine's woes, the weather changed for the worse. It may be November, but anyone who's hiked the Drakensberg knows it's a very dangerous place. When the moist winds blow in, the temperature plunged to below zero. Sleet and even some snow began to fall on the hapless forces led by Allison and Hoyes. Allison's party approached via the Champagne Castle route, convinced there was a pass from there to the Bushman's River Pass. There isn't, so they couldn't join up with Durnford at Bushman's River Pass. Got lost, and then turned back down the slopes to search for another route. Meanwhile, Durnford had managed to make it up to the Bushman's River Pass because he had Basutu leading his party. As they summited, exhausted, they saw to their great surprise, nay, horror, that an Amahlubi force of over 200 was already there. A Natal Mercury reporter along for the ride wrote that, "We venture to think that few mounted corps ever passed the more adventurous, perilous, or toilsome 50 hours ride than did the 37 Carbineers." That may be true, but worse, they had hardly any food and were critically short of ammunition. They travelled light because they had no pack animals. So here they were, a force of 37 young volunteers and a handful of Basutu guides, who were supposed to operate as a reinforcement for Captain Allison's black soldiers, who never arrived because they were lost. Pine had issued express instructions to these young hotheads of the Carbineers before they rode off from his HQ. They were not to fire the first shots should they encounter the enemy. Lang Ali Balele had travelled the same route 3 days before, but the British were only to discover that much later. A tense standoff between the parties developed. Neither group wanted to open fire first. Durnford's youngsters were exhausted, hungry. The standoff continued through the day, November 4th, 1873. The Carbineers' morale had collapsed, and then a Carbineer man shot one of the Amahlubi cattle, which they slaughtered, exacerbating the tension. Both Durnford and Amahlubi commander Mabuhle had trouble containing the younger gun-armed and more aggressive among their respective sides. Mabuhle told Durnford he should leave, but Durnford said he couldn't without Mabuhle coming along quietly. Then another shot rang out. This time a British Basutu guide had been hit. There was a general exchange of fire as the Carbineers retreated. Durnford was stabbed in the elbow and the side. He would recover from both wounds, but would remain paralyzed under the left arm and in his hand until he died, which was going to be at Isandlwana during the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. The British were vanquished and took stock. Commander wounded, 5 dead, 3 of the Carbineers, along with the Basutu guide and their main translator, Elijah Kambule. Among the 3 British dead was Robert Erskine, the son of the Natal colonial secretary. Incensed by the tragic reversal at Bushman's River Pass, the Natal authorities sent 2 flying columns in pursuit of Langalibalele, and they would enter Basutu land hunting their fugitive Amahlubi chief. Bushman's River Pass was renamed Langalibalele Pass, which can be walked today. It's a hike graded moderate on the difficulty scale, not too bad. Just make sure you check the weather carefully and take an up-to-date map or GPS. Mobile phone signals disappear up there. One of the flying columns sent to locate Langalibalele was led by Captain Allison. This time he didn't get lost and crossed into Basutu land from Natal in the Montesources area. A second column headed off in the direction of the Imzimvubu River. All hell broke loose in Natal. The colonists demanded action, so a detachment of the 75th Regiment under a recovering Major Durnford hustled off on a 6-month task of blowing up all the passes along the Drakensberg. Yes, folks, their job was to blow up the scenic Drakensberg. Other units began flushing out the Amahlubi women and children and the elderly who'd sought refuge in caves on the slopes of the mountains. It was the mopping up operations, as they were called, that led to an outcry in England. The severity of the measures employed by the Natal authorities was raised in Parliament by the powerful Anti-Slavery Society, as well as the Peace Society and the Aborigines Protection Society. They demanded a commission of inquiry. This little war was going to have major repercussions. The violence employed by the colonial forces in their follow-up operations are matter-of-factly revealed in letters to the Natal press written by individuals amongst the units, published November and December 1873. Go check them out. They also used a form of collective punishment against the entire Amahlubi and the Amangwe or the Amaputini. Soon it became clear that the authorities were after far more than just revenge. They wanted to destroy the social structure of the Amahlubi. Once that happened, it would be easier for Macfarlane and others to get their hands on cheap labour to build the colony's roads. Pine issued a proclamation in the Natal Government Gazette, December 9th, 1873, which indemnified colonial forces in respect of all acts, matters, and things done in order to suppress the rebellion and prevent the spread thereof. While all of this was going on, Langalibalele was sipping beer with Basutu Chief Morapo. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'll load updates about various episodes. You can also email me from there and sign up for my little newsletter. Until next, Salagali.